Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner.
I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And we're going to take a look at, obviously talk the next couple hours. What else? This is the main issue of the day, clearly. When we all went to bed last night, it was announced that President Barack Obama had ordered the, not capture, but actually the killing of Osama bin Laden. That took place in Pakistan. A lot of questions left open about that. We are going to explore them in both in terms of its domestic repercussions and possibilities, but also what it says about American policy in the future. Is it time for the war on terror to end? Some people would argue. Some people say no. What does it mean for the war in Afghanistan? And what does it mean that we've killed Osama bin Laden? He was, in many ways, the symbolic head of a Islamic, let me take that back, not Islamic, of a jihadist movement in the world, but he really wasn't his leader in many ways. We'll talk about all that with our guests. We're joined first by Dr. Sahar Shafkat, who is professor of political science at St. Mary's College of Maryland. Aaron Manns, who is it Manis or Manns? I'm sorry.
Manis,
I thought it would be. Aaron Manis, who is author of Profiles in Terror, a guide to Middle East terrorist organizations, and writes the Terror Wonk blog. And Aaron and Sahar, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much.
So this is, to me, I mean, there's so many things that have erupted out of this in terms of the way to look at it. In terms of its significance for the world around Afghanistan, Pakistan, where it took place, Sahar, let's start there. That you've seen so many different kind of reports coming out of Afghanistan and Pakistan of people's reactions one way or the other. I'm curious what you think, what it means for that region.
There are a lot of mixed reactions certainly coming out of that region. And let me talk about Pakistan. I think that it should be first said that I think there is a tremendous sense of relief that I think a lot of people feel because bin Laden was not a good guy. And I think that's universally shared. But I think there are a couple of different responses and emotions coming out of Pakistan right now. There's a lot of fear and uncertainty, actually. There's also some denial or some disbelief because there is no body. And unfortunately, the lack of actual physical proof is going to sort of even further fuel these conspiracy theories that Pakistan is often very famous for. The fear and uncertainty really comes, I think, from people being really worried and scared about what this means for the future of Pakistan, the sort of sense that people have that, you know, the U.S. may now want to hold Pakistan responsible for their alleged role in sheltering Osama bin Laden, and that they may want to extract a very, very heavy price in exchange for that now. So there's a lot of fear and concern about how things are going to be moving forward.
And we'll explore that in a bit more depth. And Aaron Manns, would you like to jump in on that as well?
Sure. There are, as you said, so many angles to this, and I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about the future of al-Qaeda. I'm not nearly the Pakistan expert as your other guest, but I follow the country as closely as I can, and I do worry about it. And the United States, to some extent, is paying a price for not effectively engaging the country as a whole. Too much of our relationship has been this straightforward transactional relationship with the Pakistani military. And the Pakistani military is often considered sort of a state within a state. It has its own priorities, its own obsessions, and there are cases where it's played a real double game. And I think if we broadly engaged the country as a whole, perhaps they'd be less prone to conspiracy theories, and they'd be less worried about American intentions.
What do you think? I think that is one of the things that's way up in the air about what we mean by American intentions, which is hotly debated here. I'll read some comments here from some folks that wrote in a moment about American intentions. And I think, Sahar, I mean, the American intentions is not as simple to, I think, winnow out as some would like.
I didn't catch the last part of that question. You said the American intentions are not
as easy and simple to winnow out as some would like.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think even in President Obama's statement yesterday, he made it very clear that while this was a significant, the death of bin Laden was a significant development and achievement for U.S. foreign policy and for U.S. military policy, that the war on terror continues. And, of course, Pakistan is one of the countries that has been most deeply affected by the war on terror. And so there is a tremendous amount of concern about how this is going to play out for the Pakistani people. And I absolutely concur with your other guest about the role that the Pakistani military has played. And unfortunately, the U.S. Policy's dependence on engaging only with the Pakistani military in the last, frankly, several decades, not just this last decade, has really produced a very, very unfortunate situation in which the interests of the Pakistani people, sort of the average Pakistani person, has been completely left out, both certainly domestically by the Pakistani military, but then also in U.S. policymakers' eyes, right? That segment just does not figure into this at all. And unfortunately, what the war on terror has done is simply to even more sort of more greatly reinforce the sort of oppressive tendencies of the Pakistani military. In the entire region, I think one can say that the war on terror's logic has been internalized, so that military needs and the military sort of imperative is prioritized over all else. And I mean, you know, things like development, education, all of that, but also in terms of the relationship and role played by the civilian government in relationship to the Pakistani military.
Aaron, this is Anthony McCarthy. I was struck all day by the reactions, the international reactions, as well as those here in this country. A lot of Middle East Islamic leaders saying that that they believe this was the right thing to have happened and that they supported the action. But give me your thoughts on how the American reaction has been viewed around the world. Spontaneous gatherings outside the White House, at Ground Zero, all over the country, people in the middle of the night, late in the night, came out of their homes and were celebrating and waving flags and were jubilant. I've read some of the blogs and been reading some of the things. Some folks internationally just believed it was in extraordinary poor taste. And I just wanted to get your thought on that.
That's a fascinating statement. You know, there's a wonderful line. I think it was from the great journalist A.J. Liebling, who once wrote that more sophisticated cultures always pick on like to pick on the younger sort of rising power.
Mm-hmm.
The Greeks did it to the Romans. The Italians did it to the French. The French did it to the British. Now the British do it to us. So the whole world likes to look at America and say we're in poor taste. Our patriotism
very true.
Is over the top. So be it. Other countries, for various reasons, will be out in the streets cheering, what have you. This was our moment. I do think it's interesting that religious leaders across the Middle East, whatever they think, and many of them are certainly not friends of the United States, saw this as a positive development, because the real costs here have, you know, the predominant number of victims of al-Qaeda and its philosophy have, in fact, been Muslims. That it has driven many of these societies just really to breaking points, the violence generated by al-Qaeda and its affiliates. So you really can see that. People who are not friends of the United States are definitely coming to an anti-al-Qaeda and anti-radical position.
Folks, I want you to join us here at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. What were your thoughts when you first heard President Barack Obama speak to the nation? Well, maybe you read it last night before you heard that. About the assassination, the killing of Barack Obama, of Osama mm-hmm. bin Laden by being led, really, really led by the President of the United States, Barack Obama. Your thoughts on where that takes us as a nation and your reactions to it. I mean, people were, I remember the shows we did from 9/11
when
it first happened on, and then the arguments we had in this airways for months and months and months, a year leading up to the war in Iraq, and even the issues around the Afghanistan war, and our numerous conversations with the Qayyum Karzai and other people in Afghanistan. We were also the first media outlet in the world to talk to Hamid Karzai.
That's right.
When he was hiding in a cave in Afghanistan. So we've been covering this for a long time. And just hear your thoughts. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join us with your thoughts. Or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. I mean, I think, you know, for President Barack Obama, just to switch gears for a moment, I just want to cover some broad areas and we'll focus in more depth in the things we're raising. Is it, I was looking at the – we were watching the correspondence to dinner on the internet the other night. One of the things that Seth Meyers said at the end of the said at the end of the evening was that that he didn't think any Republican could beat Barack Obama, and I think that's probably true at this point. And he said the only person who could beat Barack Obama was it was that guy Barack Obama who ran in 2008. You'd like him. Which I thought was a great quote, but politically, this says a lot about Barack Obama and how Americans will begin to view him. This kind of Americans like seeing this decisive action going on, whether they agree with the wars or not. I'm curious both of your thoughts on that, and we'll go into the other issues in greater depth. So how you want to start as professor of political science, and we'll go to Aaron Maness.
So the question is, what effect this is going to have on President Obama's political
career? Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, I think there's always a rally around the flag that happens in domestic American politics, and that is certainly going to happen in this case. I think you're right. We saw these spontaneous celebrations, especially by young people.
Yeah.
You know, you have to remember that, first of all, President Obama's election in 2008 had so much to do with mobilizing young people, and they've really been disillusioned by him over the last couple of years, and I think this may be sort of a moment in which he can win them back. You also have, of course, young people who have really only known 9/11 in their formative years, and so I think this has a particular this event has a particular resonance with them. But I also want to caution everyone that, of course, the 2012 election is many, many months away. It's 18 months away, which is more than many lifetimes in politics. So, you know, I think that this is a huge bump for the president. But I think you know, we need to stay tuned and see how this is going to play out over the next few months.
Aaron Maness?
Well, you've got me on here as an international affairs expert, but as it happens...
No, we'll get you right back to your comfort zone in just a second.
I am studying the national security decision-making process at the other end of campus here at the University of Maryland, at the School of Public Policy, and national security decision-making is, don't kid yourself, highly political.
Yes.
There's a whole literature about the American presidency and how... On one level, he has enormous power, but on the other hand, he has very little power. So it sort of depends on how good a story he can tell, how well he can persuade the American people he knows what he's doing, and that he can do all sorts of things, and he has a lot of political capital. And a move like this really can't help but help. Now, that all that being said, it's always going to be the economy, stupid. And if the economy gets better, then he'll do just fine. If the economy does not, it doesn't matter how many guys from Al-Qaeda he catches.
Mark, and I found it interesting that even the Republican leadership was very careful at how far they went at praising the president. And you would only see a certain amount of the leadership actually making statements, because I think they're very conscious that any statements that the speaker makes, any statement that the leadership of the Republican Party makes, will be played back to them in this upcoming election. And so as you saw, a lot of Republican members of Congress, Republican senators, actually praising the president for his decisiveness, for making the decision at that moment when he had to make the decision to move forward, that they were praising him. They were very cautious as well, because as Sahar said, this election is many months away, and they need several pressure points to be able to apply to this president as he goes for re-election.
Let me take it back to the international arena for a moment. And we're here, by the way, Anthony McCarthy and I are here with Sahar Shafkat, who is professor of political science at St. Mary's College of Maryland, Aaron Maness, who is author of Profiles in Terror, a guide to Middle East terrorist organizations, and works at the Laboratory of Contemporary Cultural Dynamics at the University of
Maryland. Computational Cultural Dynamics.
It's written on my sheet. Computational. Pardon me, my friend. Computational Cultural Dynamics, University of Maryland. 410-319-8888. But the question is, what I said earlier was, in many ways, at least from my perspective, Osama bin Laden was the symbolic embodiment of terror to the West and to many people, and in the Islamic world as well, Muslim world as well. So he's gone. So what? So, I mean, by that I mean, not to be flippant, but that terror is a very decentralized effort. Terrorist groups are very decentralized around the world. So Osama bin Laden's been taken out. We had 10 years of a war in Afghanistan so far. And what this took was police work, investigative work, and then an attack on Osama bin Laden. So he's gone. But what does that have to do with the face of terror on the planet? Aaron Manis first and Sahar next, Shafkat.
Big question. So there's a lot of different levels to look at this, big surprise. There's an old line, amateurs talk strategy, professionals talk logistics. The same goes for terrorism. To carry out a terrorist attack, you need to move people in secret from place to place. You need to get supplies to the right place, all that kind of nuts and bolts stuff. Since 9/11, we are doing an increasingly competent job at raising the barriers to strikes on the American homeland. That's getting much, much harder to do. Not saying it's impossible, but it's harder. At the same time, catching bin Laden, apparently there was a treasure trove of documents, and here too, you know, nuts and bolts. Whatever we knew about al-Qaeda before, we know a lot. We're going to know a lot more now. And one of the things that is coming out in the reporting of this operation is that our intelligence agencies are getting much better at cooperating and sharing intelligence. And the expectation is they'll be able to process this information fairly quickly, and there may be other successes in the relatively near future. On the grander stage, I'm not as worried about terrorists coming to the United States and carrying out attacks, but I am worried about instability in places like Yemen, Pakistan, Egypt, all over the world. And these could have all kinds of geopolitical ramifications, which would be unpleasant, not just for us, but really, you know, for everyone. Instability in the Middle East leads to increased energy prices, which spurs inflation for everything. And we're seeing, you know, we've seen food riots across the Middle East. We're seeing them in Uganda. We'll see more of them. That's not good for anyone. The other thing is that bin Laden was a symbol, but fundamentally, much of the Muslim world has a wide range of grievances, and those aren't going away so quickly, and they are not very easy to address.
Sahar?
You know, it's an excellent question, because I think that's exactly the question that a lot of people are asking, especially, I would say, in Pakistan, because, of course, the war in Afghanistan and the larger war on terror, the war that has now, of course, now moved into Pakistan as well, was all launched ostensibly to go after this guy. And we have now spent close to 10 years, over $1 trillion, hundreds and thousands of lives lost, multiple wars, and we got him. And the natural question that everyone is asking, especially in Pakistan, is, well, then this means the war is over, right? This means that the U.S. is going to leave the region, which is something that a very high percentage of people want. In fact, U.S. involvement in both Afghanistan and Pakistan has only proved to be more destabilizing as time has worn on. And it's very interesting to me that even last night, as the president was speaking, he was immediately kind of building in a rationale for continuing the war effort and continuing current U.S. policies, which is going to be certainly seen with a lot of disappointment and anxiety in Pakistan, and also by people all over the world who seek peace, because this is, you know, this seems at first like a major event, and yet might end up being really more of a symbolic blip in terms of the continuation of policies.
I mean, there are many people arguing that this is a reason why we can begin to end the war in Afghanistan. It wasn't the war that found Osama bin Laden. It wasn't the war that has allowed the United States to take out and capture different members of al-Qaeda and terrorist groups around the world. It has been this police work, and then the actions by trained troops to go in and go get folks. So the question is, I mean, this can raise a lot of questions in terms of debate. Why do we need this war in Afghanistan? What role is it playing in stabilizing the region and stabilizing our interests, or in capturing what we call terrorists? Aaron Manis.
Well, one theory is that ungoverned spaces anywhere can become a base for malevolent actors. And to some extent, it depends on where the base is. There are places that are so far removed from the rest of the world that maybe it's not a problem. there are other places, like Afghanistan is close to Pakistan. It's in a strategic region. So the disorder in Pakistan kicks over into, I mean, disorder in Afghanistan kicks into Pakistan and in turn into India, and it can have regional effects. I mean, 9/11 was generated out of Afghanistan, although, strictly speaking, that wasn't disordered. It was just ordered in a horrible way under the Taliban. The other question is, there is also the humanitarian side of it, which is that the people who are likely to be running Afghanistan, the Taliban and its various factions, when the U.S. leaves are not the nicest people. And the United States can't afford to intervene everywhere in the world on humanitarian grounds, and ideally there'd be means of intervention besides military ones. But it is certainly something to consider. We prefer governments that don't commit mass murder and mistreat their women, etc.
But Sahara, I guess there are many people you interview in Afghanistan that would agree that they don't want the Taliban to come back, especially women who have stood up. But even though many of those women that you interview don't want the United States troops there.
Of course. Well, yes, that's exactly right. I mean, of course, nobody likes the Taliban, but the very, very ugly fact is that the current regime of Hamid Karzai includes many people who have done exactly, committed exactly the same kinds of crimes that members of the Taliban have, that are, and that there is mistreatment and oppression of women happening right now under our ally government, under Hamid Karzai. So I really do take exception to this idea that we must remain in Afghanistan due to humanitarian reasons. In fact, there are many who've made the argument that remaining in Afghanistan is actually making things worse. I also wanted to go back to an earlier point you made about this being sort of the death of bin Laden being really the result of some kind of police action.
Yeah.
Right. I think that's really significant because you're exactly right that all these billions and trillions of dollars and human lives lost have actually not resulted in the ostensible goal we set for ourselves almost 10 years ago. In fact, it was intelligence. It was sort of good old-fashioned intelligence. It was a more sort of strategic and surgical police, almost police-like actions. And that is also kind of connected to the way in which all of this unfolded, which has to do with the legality of bin Laden's death, right? I mean, imagine if imagine if bin Laden had in fact been captured alive and had been presented to an international criminal tribunal or the criminal court, the symbolic value of that, not just having caught this horrible human being, but in fact also subjecting him to the rule of law and to what we profess to be our values of fairness and due process, would have been just magnificent, and it's just really unfortunate that that opportunity was lost.
Sahara, I want to ask you, we have some callers on the line, yeah. And we're getting close to our break, but I want to ask you, I was reading earlier today some of the real anger a lot of Americans are expressing towards Pakistan. What is at risk for Pakistan? I mean, we have this complicated relationship with them. But they are our ally in the region and our partner in this war on terror, quote unquote. But there is a great deal of energy being directed to the fact that Osama bin Laden was found in a residential area. I think many of us had this vision that he was holed up in some cave somewhere, and it was very difficult for a lot of the Pakistani officials to find him or to. I think they had more of an excuse, given the myth that we had built around Osama bin Laden. What's at risk for Pakistan and their relationship with the United States right now?
That's a great question. There's a tremendous amount at risk, and I think this is continuing a rift that was first exposed with the Raymond Davis affair. For those
yes.
of you who recall, he was a CIA subcontractor who had been caught and was eventually sort of literally paid to be removed from Pakistan, and it created a lot of resentment in Pakistan against the United States. And so there's clearly a rift between the United States and Pakistan. Unfortunately, you know, this is the result of a very long, decades-long policy that the United States has pursued, which is to engage with Pakistan only through its military establishment. And the military in Pakistan is not at all interested in the welfare and best interests of its people. It is interested in the welfare of its own institution, of the military itself, of making sure that its interests are protected. And the war on terror and U.S. engagement recently has only further aggravated that. And I think what this has also exposed, this death of bin Laden has exposed, is that there's a very, very serious break, I think, between the United States and the Pakistani military establishment. I found it very significant that the president did not, in fact, acknowledge or thank or even really mention anybody in the Pakistani military establishment,
right,
but only the civilian president, Zardari.
That's right.
410-319-8888 is the number here. When they get to your call, just take a call before we go to break, and then we'll come back with some further questions for Sahar Shafkat and Aaron Maness. I'm here with Anthony McCarthy, my Monday co-host and dear friend. 410-319-8888. Spending 2 hours today looking at different aspects of the assassination of Osama bin Laden, what it means for future policy, where we change things and move from billion dollar wars over 10 years to special ops and investigations and maybe some other kind of foreign policy that brings the Islamic world and the Western world closer together. Some people would argue, we'll talk about this in a bit, that that the uprisings for freedom and liberty and justice throughout the Arab world over the last months have done more to blunt al-Qaeda than the raids we do. We'll talk about that in a moment as a theoretical question. For our guest, 410-319-8888. Hank, you're on the air.
How you doing today, young man?
Good, Hank. Welcome.
Hey, guests and everybody, and Mr. Young Men.
Go ahead.
It's money. It's the duel today.
Thank you.
One, I think that this is my belief, and this is what my rider who rides me every day at the time says, right? They got rid of the body too fast, right? I don't believe that. If they had them, they should have killed them right away, right? Because we, as people, constantly talk about the just ways of doing things, right? Now, yeah, granted, he killed somebody, but so did Hitler. Hitler had to kill himself. Goering and all of them at least had their chance in court, and everybody had a chance for closure, right? Two, when he came out and said that, I think he could have been a little bit more remorseful. Three, yeah, we looking like idiots standing out there jumping around like them people. Because the minute that somebody takes a reporter and gets and jumps around and yeah, we are very upset, outlandish, and fiendish with them people. And that's my belief, right? I think that we shouldn't have been all out there, yeah, USA, USA, right? Because that man has a home country, and his people, al-Qaeda, they really want to, you know, attack us.
Let's mull on this a minute and come back from this break, and we'll pick up the topics that Hank has brought to our table. 410-319-8888. We're here with Dr. Sahar Shafkat, Dr. Aaron Maness. Sahar Shafkat is a professor of political science at St. Mary's College. Aaron Maness is with the Laboratory for Computational Cultural Dynamics at the University of Maryland and author of Profiles in Terror, A Guide to Middle East Terrorist Organizations. When we return, Robert Dreyfuss from The Nation magazine will be joining us as well. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Vernie, you're the next caller up. And Anthony McCarthy and I will be right back, so please stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And we are joined by Sahar Shafkat, who is professor of political science at St. Mary's College, Aaron Maness, who is author of Profiles in Terror, A Guide to Middle East Terrorist Organizations, who works at the Laboratory of Computational Cultural Dynamics at the University of Maryland College Park. And we are now also joined by Robert Dreyfuss, who is contributing editor of Nation magazine. Robert, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
Thanks. My pleasure.
So one of the questions here at the end here, and there's a huge banner going across the New York Times on the web right now, and the banner says that President Barack Obama says the world is now safer. And I wonder if, you know, we all have to make political statements, political elected leaders do, to kind of justify their actions and make things sound often better than they are. While it's not equivalent to saying we've won when George Bush co-piloting a plane on
mission accomplished.
Mission accomplished. That was the line. It's not quite a mission accomplished. The world's safer, Robert Dreyfuss?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I guess you could make the case that it is safer, because I do believe that the killing of bin Laden will help weaken, if not fatally undermine, the al-Qaeda organization. Now, of course, the organization is split and splintered in many ways, and there are franchise groups in other countries around the world. By the same token, they have not been particularly active over the last several years. There's certainly very little serious terrorism that can be attributed to them. They've been on the run. They've been in hiding. Their influence and danger has been exaggerated. But still and all, this was a bad guy who we vowed to eliminate after the attacks of 9/11, and we've done so. So I think, you know, as far as that goes, it's correct. Now, the big question is, you know, what does the United States do next? And one of the points that I've been making today is that it kind of removes the props from under the reason why we're in Afghanistan, if there were any left. That war has been looking like it's making less and less sense recently, and now it seems to make no sense at all, since al-Qaeda is, you know, got a few more nails in its coffin, and the Taliban has never attacked us. So it isn't really clear to me, and in fact to most Americans, what we're doing there now at all.
Sahar, let me let you jump in next, if I might. I know you have to leave in about 10 minutes.
That's right. Well, are we safer? That's a great question, but I think it depends on who the we are as well. I think as Robert is alluding to, the people of Afghanistan and the people in Pakistan haven't been safer. And actually, I think that there's a lot of fear and anxiety in Pakistan today, because there's some very real concern that the U.S. is going to extract an even bigger price from the country for the fallout of this particular event. But I absolutely agree that there are going to be louder questions now about the U.S. presence in Afghanistan and, by extension, in Pakistan as well. And I suspect we're going to see a lot of very determined efforts to create a rationale that sort of extends that presence. And again, we saw the president start doing this last night.
Aaron Maness, I want to ask you the flip side of this. A lot of people talking about, you know, and we do know that al-Qaeda has been splintered, and there are these different groups, and they've been fractionalized for some time. But with the death of Osama bin Laden, some worry that he will become a martyr for these organizations, these splintered organizations, to come together, and that they will begin the process of figuring out how to exact a price from the United States for the death of Osama bin Laden. I mean, I hate to be a downer, but I think that a lot of people have a question mark about what's next for the United States.
Well, I'm not persuaded that al-Qaeda had some super strikes and was just holding back, waiting for the right moment. And as I said, the nuts and bolts of carrying out an effective terrorist attack, it's hard to do. If you look at the kinds of attacks we've seen over the past decade and the shape they've taken, we've seen a real decrease in sophistication in the long-range attacks. That is where they're, you know, within Afghanistan, the attacks have been very sophisticated. But, for example, the farther-out attacks when they've tried to hit things in Europe have not been terribly sophisticated. The doctor's plot in Scotland, well, they couldn't build a bomb, so they ended up driving their truck into the airport and starting a fire, which was put out pretty quickly. Not pleasant, not a good day, but, you know, certainly not 9/11. The casualties were mainly themselves. We've seen lots of poorly made bombs. So I really think that their capabilities are, at least in terms of the long-term strike, are degraded. But again, the ideology is still there. It will remain attractive. And yes, bin Laden will be a martyr. I don't know if that will help or hurt recruiting efforts. I think it's marginal that that ideology has a real hold on a substantial number of people, enough people that under the right circumstances, they can cause a great deal of grief and instability.
Well, there are a couple of different things here. I think the question that Anthony just raised, it's you, Aaron. And Sahar, I know you have to leave in a few minutes. Let me go to you and then to Robert and then Verna. You're the next caller up. We're going to come right to your call. Verna and Leo, we're going to get right to your calls in just a minute. But it does beg a question because of what Aaron Maness just said. I mean, if in fact many of these terror organizations, other than the kind of attacks that were carried out within Iraq, or the attacks we saw in Indonesia, or the attacks or the battle before that was happening in the Philippines, other places like that, which were internal terror attacks in Islamic countries that killed many people, then the question, if it is other than that, in that kind of disarray, then what is it? What should American policy be? What are we actually fighting? I mean, what are these both wars and also these operations by our intelligence services and special ops really doing? I mean, I think it really does beg that question, unless I misunderstood what Aaron said. I'm sure he'll come back and correct me if I'm misinterpreting him. Sahar?
You know, I think that one of the things that Bin Laden was able to do was to sort of globalize terror, right, and to globalize all of these different grievances that people had in very different parts of the world, and then bring them together with strategy and personnel and all of that, and focus it on a very specific target, namely the United States and its assets. As point of fact, most terrorist attacks are actually very localized. They are not, in fact, the sort of global level of attack. And so even the ones that you're talking about in Indonesia or in other places are very local and localized, and really are about some very specific local grievances and about very specific local political, social issues. And, you know, you're asking sort of a really difficult question, which is what should we do instead to combat this problem? And I'm certainly not going to pretend as if I have the comprehensive answer. But I can say that one shift we need to make is to stop thinking about all of these acts of violence as being motivated by and being coordinated by the same entity, and really start to think of these as very specific individual acts that are being motivated by very specific local contexts. And in order to figure out what we should do about all of them, we need to first understand what is driving each of them separately.
And Sahar, I know you have to run now. I do appreciate you being part of the show, Sahar Shafkat. I look forward to having you back again very soon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Take care.
Robert Dreyfuss, you want to pick up on that? We'll go back to Aaron.
Yeah, well, I think, as I was saying earlier, there's been a huge inflation of the threat from al-Qaeda since 9/11, and it's been used as a boogeyman to justify everything from a bigger defense budget to the attack on Iraq, which of course made no sense at all, and now to justify the attack on or the continuing war in Afghanistan. I'm hoping that the killing of Bin Laden will let some of the air out of that balloon. The issue of terrorism is something that can be dealt with. Most experts will say through intelligence, through law enforcement, perhaps selective use of special forces like was used in this case over the weekend with Osama bin Laden. But it doesn't have to involve large military forces. It doesn't have to involve counterinsurgency effort. It doesn't have to involve nation building and regime changes. And all of that, which has become kind of almost a biblical precept for the Pentagon over the last 10 years, I think can pretty much be thrown out the window, and we can reduce fighting terrorism to like, you know, we fight crime. We don't mobilize the military when banks get robbed. And so we don't need to mobilize the military when there's a terrorist incident. If someone shoots up a mall tomorrow in response to this attack, you know, it's a bunch of bad guys doing something bad, and we need to track them down, and we need to use our intelligence service and the FBI to try to make sure that we keep track of people who might be doing that in the future. But we certainly don't need to involve the Pentagon. So I think
really that's the shift that has to occur now. We have to spin away from a military response and fall back to an intelligence and law enforcement response.
Let's open the phone chain. We'll come back to Albert Manis. 410-319-8888. Your thoughts. Osama bin Laden has been assassinated, murdered, taken out, however you like to think of it, killed by the United States government. And where does this leave us and where does this take us? What questions does it open? Does it really close any questions we've had? 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Verna, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Mr. Steiner.
Good afternoon.
I want to comment two major things that have always bothered me. Number one is the language that's always used when they deal with Muslim countries, okay? Number two is the preoccupation with the way the women dress. Anything happened in any Muslim country, the first thing they say is the woman had a hijab on or something like that. In that same vein, I want you to take a look at France, who is now in Libya, fighting a war with people who did nothing to them, like the United States always is, all right, on the premise that they're there to help the people. A statement was issued not too long ago in France. Do you see those stupid hijabs they wear on their head? If this is the feeling they have about Muslim women, how can you say it with the other side of your mouth that you're in there to help the people, okay? This whole thing seems to me a war on our Islam. If you look at all the terrorist acts committed in the United States, mainly against people of color, I wonder what you would call that man who dragged that man up behind the truck in Texas a couple of years back with his head off. I wonder what he would be called. What would you call that old man in the South who killed Emmett Till, a 14-year-old boy who was mutilated, castrated, stabbed, beat, and shot? Are these people not terrorists? What do you call the Jews in Israel?
Okay, but so they're terrorists. So what's, I know, I don't disagree, Verna. Verna, excuse me. Without just going, Verna, excuse me. Verna,
are they not terrorists?
Verna, excuse me.
The Jews did this, or the Christians did this.
Verna, I'm breaking in because I understand that. So what's the question you want to ask with all that? What's the question you want to ask with that? I think that many people would agree that those who did those acts, Emmett Till and the rest, were terrorists. The Klan were terrorists. I mean, it's no question.
Terrorists. Why don't they address them like that?
So what was, what's the, I mean, what, I just wanted to figure out what
the... Osama bin Laden is not the one that I think should be held up. Oh, we did this. The United States has so much blood on their hand, they cannot afford to hold up anybody as a terrorist except their own selves.
Okay. Verna, thank you so much for your thoughts and comments. Let me see if Albert Manis or Robert Drivers would like to respond.
Well, I mean, this is Bob Dreyfus. I think it confuses the issue to call people who commit acts of violence, even when they're reprehensible ones, terrorists. A terrorist has a political message that they're trying to use. Osama bin Laden is not just a random terrorist or racist, you know, killing someone for racist reasons. He has a political objective, which is to rally the Muslim world behind his perverted view of what Islam stands for, and to try to build a new Islamic nation, a caliphate that would stand up to what he sees as the assault of Christian and Jewish civilizations. Now, that may be all nonsense, but it does represent a political point of view, and that's what terrorism is. It's violence used against civilian targets for some sort of political purpose. And in that case, you know, bin Laden certainly fits into that. That isn't to say that excuses actions, whether by individuals or by countries like the American invasion of Iraq, which I think was illegal and wrong. And yet, I mean, it's hard to say that's terrorism. It's something else, and it's bad, but it doesn't mean that, you know, everything is terrorism just because people die from it.
And Albert Manis, I think that when you look at the question you explored earlier, I'd like to take one step further because of the question that we asked about if in fact what you were saying earlier is correct, then what is what is the course the world should take in all this? I mean, I think that if things are so decentralized and we're wasting trillions of dollars on wars that many people would argue do not need to be fought, and a different kind of action has to be taken, both in terms of our political response to the Arab and Muslim world and as well as our response to the terrorists, and how we might have to do this in a much more covert way if we're going to address it in that way.
Oh, so a grand strategy in 5 minutes? I'll see what I can do.
About three. I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
So I think, look, looking back over the decade, I mean, 9/11 required a vigorous response. I'm not sure if our response was the right one, but a vigorous response. Quiet, covert action was probably not adequate. Something had metastasized across the Muslim world that had to be addressed vigorously. That being said, did we need to revamp our entire national security apparatus to go after a guy and his couple of hundred followers? Maybe not. I am very interested. You know, nation building, maybe non-military nation building, that is helping nations build effective institutions, that's useful. The State Department has an incredible program, and it's an anti-terror training program, which isn't just training cops. They train prosecutors how to prosecute crimes. They train the financial management people of the country how to monitor financial transactions. So these kinds of programs don't just help in counterterror; they help across the board. Indonesia received counterterror finance training, but then when the tsunami hit, their financial institutions were better equipped to take large charitable donations. So we really do have an interest in how other countries work and helping them function better. Can we do it with a lighter hand? I think so. And will that really garner us some rewards in counterterrorism? Absolutely.
Robert Dreyfus, I want to ask you really quickly, and it's unfair to ask such a question when we only have a couple of minutes left, but is there a place left in the world for a wealthy, charismatic zealot to begin a revolution like that so many people have placed on the shoulders of Osama bin Laden to fill that hole? Or again, are we inflating the influence that Osama bin Laden had around the world?
Oh, I don't think he had a great deal of influence. Look, we just saw revolutions in Egypt, Tunisia. There's something happening in Syria and Yemen and Bahrain. There's rumblings in Jordan and Morocco. These are revolutions. And none of them, not one, had anything to do with Osama bin Laden. It had very little to do with Islamism. These were independent actions by people who wanted freedom and democracy and economic progress. I think the reason why there is not room for a crazy ideologue like bin Laden, except, you know, to be able to rally a tiny minority of people to join his cause, which, you know, that can happen anywhere at any time, is to try to remove the reasons why people become radicals. And that has much more to do with particular political and economic grievances, with poverty, with hunger, with disease, with humiliation that people feel in various countries where they live, where radicalism appeals to them and where people like bin Laden can then get a word in edgewise. And so the way you deal with that in the future is you try to remove the recruiting grounds and the reasons why people become radicalized. And yes, that takes years or decades, but it's really the only solution. People joined Islamist movements starting especially 40 years ago because they felt they had nowhere to turn. The only place they could organize was in the mosque, and because the Muslim extremists were saying Islam is the solution. And now people are finding that there are other solutions, there are other voices, there are other ways of acting, and hopefully, you know, we've turned a corner, not only in terms of killing bin Laden, but in terms of that entire region beginning to come out of the funk that it was in and move into the modern era.
Let me go back to the phones. Leo, you're on the air. Hi, Leo, you there?
Yes.
Welcome.
Good evening, Mark and Anthony and friends. Very briefly, unlike some of your previous callers, I do believe, in fact, we killed bin Laden. Okay, so I have no questions in that regard. But what I will say is that terrorism is in the eye of the beholder. Terrorism is defined by whom? Our American drone technology, is that an act of terrorism with political objectives? The killing of the Palestinians by Israeli forces in too many instances? Are there political objectives in that regard? And the bombing of the Gaddafi family compound, resulting in the death of his son and others, are there political objectives? Again, bin Laden got what he deserved, and I don't question that under these circumstances. But I will only say that violence begets violence, and those of us in the Western world who define civilization better understand that we too are not civilized. For whom the bells toll, they may well toll for thee. And I think that's something we've got to remember. Tit for tat violence, perhaps we can do no better at this point in our evolutionary development of civilization. But that's where we are, tit for tat. What are our real objectives? Are we going to become civilized?
Very good question. I mean, good thought, Leo. I appreciate that. Aaron Maness, you want to
let me say this. Under the laws of war, which are certainly imperfect, there are sort of rules about who can be targeted and who can't. And from everything that has come out publicly, the United States takes great efforts with those drone strikes to target people that they believe are al-Qaeda, al-Qaeda affiliates, Taliban, people in armed conflict with the U.S. Israel, too, by most accounts, takes great effort to target armed combatants. However, there's the fog of war, and this goes back, you know, to the dawn of time, distinguishing between civilians and combatants can be very challenging under any circumstance. That we call these precision weapons, but let's face it, these are large explosives. They're not quite that precise. They're not magic death rays. I do find the caller's broader point, violence has been part of civilization since the dawn, or rather been part of human nature since the dawn of time. It'd be great to think we could outgrow it. I'm not sure. Maybe I'm just not an optimist in that regard.
And Bob Dreyfus, we have a couple minutes before break. Would you like to take us there?
Yeah, well, I don't know if we can outgrow violence or not. I'm not a utopian, but I do agree with the caller's examples that these are all three of those, the Libya action, what Israel does, our attacks in Iraq and the drone attacks, all these things are cases of unjustified violence. And you know, that's our job as citizens is to try to express ourselves to our elected leaders and to organize grassroots movements that try to get the country, you know, on the right course. And that, too, is something that's going to take a long time.
We're taking a very brief break. When we come back, Bob Dreyfus will remain with us, contributing editor of Nation Magazine, and we'll be joined by Mehmal Sarfraz, who is op-ed editor at the Daily Times in Lahore, Pakistan, and Devin Haggerty, a professor of political science at UMBC, who focuses on Afghanistan and Pakistan in his work. So let me right now thank Aaron Maness for joining us. It's been a pleasure to have you on for the last hour. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Anytime.
And we'll be right back. Anthony McCarthy and I will be, and remind you on the way out to break, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. We'll be right back.